Fairfield County live and local. It's John Kamal from 95.9 The Fox. I'm hanging out tonight with a singer-songwriter, lifetime musician, and an author as well, Stephen Kellogg. It's good to have you here, man.
Good to be here, John. Good to see you.
You're a Fairfield County dude like myself. You went to prep, right?
I did. Interestingly, though, I had grown up in Fairfield, and in middle of eighth grade, both my parents moved to Bridgeport. So I lived in Bridgeport for many years after, but yeah. I wasn't going to switch school systems right at that time. So I ended up going to prep sort of against my will. But it was a good school, a good place to be.
That's so funny that you said. I literally moved out of Bridgeport 2 days ago.
Oh, did you? Where did you live? 2 days
ago. I was in Black Rock. I was on Midland Street.
Okay. Yeah, man. I was on Beachmont. I was sort of in the north, but anyway, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Bridgeport
roots.
So you're a Renaissance man, dude. And you've got this incredible event coming up on Saturday. You and many other artists across all of Connecticut that I'm so excited about. And I've got the thing up here. Here we go. Homegrown Folk, a live stream music festival this Saturday. And but I want to talk about you for a minute. So you're a singer-songwriter. You've been a band leader in the past. What got you into playing music? What got you into playing guitar?
Well, I mean, my sister took me to see Whitesnake when I was 10, you know, at the Coliseum. And it just it seemed the idea that I would get to do this in the long run is still amazing to me. I'm 44 now, but at 10, that was like the thing that fired me up and got me going. And then just, I kept trying to work straight jobs and it wasn't working great for me. So, next thing you know, you're a middle-aged guy and you've been doing it for 20 years, you know?
I love that you said what my literal next question was going to be. Were your early influences like kind of folky stuff like you're doing now, or was it something different? But what was it about seeing a band like Whitesnake, just pure 80s, high energy, like in your face rock and roll?
Man, there was nothing, at least it struck me, there was nothing too self-aware about it all. They were going for it. You know, you went to a show and it was like, we're going to put on a show. They're going to get dressed up for it. They're going to deliver you. They're going to take you out of your life for the night, you know? And I still, even though I play much rootsier music than that, I've always held on to that, that when you go to a show, it's not just like, hey, let me play the songs and maybe I'll tell you a little story. Like, to me, I want people to leave just being like, whoa, I can't believe that just happened. And in lieu of the pyro or the outfits and things, now what I try to give people is a lot of stories. I want them to laugh and I want them to cry. I want them to feel like, whoa, that was a concert, you know?
It's got to be a performance, right? Like a performance in the real sense of the word, not just a guy on stage playing guitar. That's not a performance. That's a guy on stage playing guitar.
Yeah, and there's so many people that do that way better than I do. If you came to just hear like a singer or a guitarist, like I'm not really your guy, but I want, but the full sensory situation of like that was a show that someone thought out, like that I'm very into, you know.
Right. Right. So was pursuing music as a profession, was that a conscious choice, or were you just having a little success and you were like, "Hey, let me see how far I can push this?" Where did that decision come from?
That's a great question. And I think it's relevant to some of the people that'll hear this. You know, growing up in Fairfield County, everybody loves to tell you, what are you really going to do? What's your fallback? There's all this, I don't know why we think we need to discourage young people from following things they're actually passionate about, but yeah. I fell into that, you know? And so I don't have any regrets. I went to school and I studied regular things and I worked a few jobs after college and no regrets. But also the thing that always gave me joy and that seemed to bring in a few bucks was that I would play music. And when I actually started, when I stopped listening to that voice of what am I really going to do and just committed to it, the rest has been history. That, you know, like that's when I started living, 24, 25 years old. Last time I had a proper job and I just and it always worked ever since then, you know.
That had to be scary, though. I mean, like, that had to be a scary choice to make. We come from, like, you know, and I've lived in Fairfield County since I was 16 years old. Like, you come from this affluent, you know, part of the country where, like you said, everybody's always looking at you like, okay, but what are you really going to do? Oh, you're still doing the guitar. That's fair. It's very nice.
Yeah, what patronizing,
are you
right.
Very, you know.
Yeah.
Those first couple of years must have been really scary. What did you just quit the job in like a dramatic fashion? Was it a gradual phasing out of other things?
Well, you know, I got things were moving better in my music scene than they were in my job selling advertising for a music company. But that's what I was doing. I was working for a venue and I would sell, you know, ads to help support their promote their thing. And it was hard. That was hard work because I wasn't super into it, you know.
Right.
The music work, it's not that it was so lucrative, but it was so rewarding. And I was making comparable money. And I just kind of like, so I do tell people, like, look, you got to be a responsible human. You got to look after yourself. So you go out and you do need to work. And sometimes that work isn't glamorous at all. But if you know that it's going to get you, you know, that just drives me more to like, all right, then let me try to get more gigs. And if I get so many gigs, I can't go to an office anymore, then I know I should quit. And that's essentially what happened. You know, I got offered a tour with Sally Taylor, who's the daughter of James Taylor and Carly Simon.
Oh, wow.
And the pay was $50 a gig, but it was like at real venues, good venues, you know? And I just thought, I'm going to figure out how to make this work. And that was 2001, you know?
What was that first tour like? Were you married at that point?
I wasn't married. I did end up marrying my high school sweetheart. So she was part of that. She remembers that, you know, but it was unreal. You're trying to find a place to, you're trying to take $50 a night. You've got to sell some CDs. I guess I had one CD at that time, and you've got to sell it because it's like, otherwise you can't afford the hotel.
Do you have merch at this point? Do you have like the shirts? Yeah.
Necessity is the mother of invention. So I think I probably had a shirt and a CD. And as much, and some nights I would really feel like I wasn't doing a good job up there because I was pretty new to professional music. And you had to learn, like, if I don't say anything about what I'm bringing to people, I might not sell anything, and then I won't have any money to pay for a hotel or whatever. So you really, you take it seriously then, you know, it's like you commit to it. And I think bands like Whitesnake, these, Being a professional musician, whatever genre you're in, it's about committing to it, you know, and believing you have something to say.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So at this point, were you touring just as yourself, solo act, or did you have the band with you?
No, I was.
Also, you've been a band leader. You've played in a band, Steve Kellogg and the Sixers. What was this era? Was this with band or without band?
Yeah. So that shift happened. That shift happened because those early days, those first tours, I was totally solo. I would usually try to coax my friends, you know, some friend to, hey, come tour manage for me for a few days, and I'd get somebody out on the road just for some company, you know. I didn't even, because I didn't really have cell phone then, I don't think. And then in 2003, I met two guys. I sort of reacquainted with two guys I had known in college, Boots Factor and Kit Carlson. Mm-hmm. And we, we started to become more of a band. It was more like it started to feel like they were my E Street Band or my Heartbreakers. I was still sort of driving the train, but I had some co-captains. And in 2004, that paid off and we got signed to Universal Records, and that kind of notched things up and the opportunities got bigger. And, you know, we've gotten to do some really heady stuff. And we've also continued to know exactly where we came from too. You know, it's that has been my career from then till now, very much the both.
I've always been a band guy. I play guitar. I don't really sing. So from my perspective, music has always been about just this collaboration, this like forced collaboration with a group of people. Not that it isn't for independent singer songwriters too. You know what I mean? But I guess what I'm asking is what's the main difference creatively between being with the Sixers and it just being yourself, or is there one?
Yeah, well, certainly initially, and given where I just told you I came from, for me, having a band was something I always wanted. You know, I wanted to play rock and roll music. And
Whitesnake, right.
You know, yeah, it had kind of morphed into probably more of a Counting Crows type vibe, sure. You know, but and so really it became about, can you find people you want to be in a relationship with? Because essentially that's what a band is. You know, you spend a lot of time together and you're collaborating. And when these guys came in, and then more there, we added more members later, but they were the core. And it really became about, can we afford a new member? You know, have we found the right member? If those two things happen, then you're off and running. And so we did that, and we did that for 10 years. And, but we grew up that way. And you kind of, I mean, at that point we were selling out 1,000 seaters and really doing some good business, but it's still a lot of time with people that aren't your wife and aren't your kids and aren't those. And I think at some point it stopped working, you know? And so, so then I still hire bands, and I'm still close with some of those musicians that I played with in that band, but it just became less practical to always have a band. So now I tour a lot solo, and I try to replace some of that musicality with stories, good stories and good lyrics, you know?
Right. Well, that's one of the things that I find most fascinating about you is you're a dad. You were telling me earlier, you have four daughters. You married your high school sweetheart. And you're not, I mean, you're a pretty young guy. So that means you've been with her for like most of your life at this point.
Yeah.
How do you balance that? And that's not even just a question at this point for artists and musicians and people on the road. I think that's a question for everybody. We live in such a hectic, chaotic world right now.
Yeah.
Even for myself, I have selfish reasons for asking this question. How do you manage the demands of a family with the demand of touring and keeping up such a busy public schedule in the public life?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know you're a father as well. And so, you know, you can appreciate how clunky this particular gig as a parent is, you know.
That's a great word. That's a great word.
You try.
Sorry, you know, I love that word.
You wake up and you try every day. And, you know, the subtitle, my book is called Objects in the Mirror, but the subtitle is Thoughts on a Perfect Life from an Imperfect Person. Because the reality is that, you know, I can share my best thoughts and practices on how to balance that with you, but it doesn't mean that I don't have a lot of days that I end up, you know, yelling at my kids, I'm not your servant, you guys. You know, I mean, there are a lot, we try, you know, and I think that's the first part of it, you know. And one of the things the last year has shown me is that you can, prior to this past year, I spent 19 years on the road a lot. I missed a lot of things with my kids and my wife growing up, but we do it and we've done it because we all love each other. And one of the things the last year taught me is you can also be right next to somebody and not be present to what's going on. You know, like I was so panicked when this all began and all this work was canceling. How was I going to take care of my family? That I was in like a DEFCON mode and very, you know, for months people are talking about, well, at least you're with your family. And I'm like, I wasn't, you know. And I also realized that there were years that I worked constantly where I was very connected to my family. So you start to realize it's about more than just physically being there. It's about listening. It's about making your desire to be a good husband and a good dad as strong as your desire to succeed in your career and to succeed in your, you know, whatever your ambitions are. And so you take those things on and really make them priorities. And then that's going to affect the kind of, you know, you just, you balance comes that way, but you prioritize what's really important to you, you know?
I mean, that's really well said. I think, yeah, I mean, this last year has been loneliness has been a common theme for everybody in this last year. And that's including people, you know, like us who have families. It's entirely possible to be right next to someone to be completely disconnected from them. I love this book, and you mentioned this, and it's a companion piece with the album that you released in 2018 of the same name too, Objects in the Mirror. This tagline, though, and you touched on it a second ago, thoughts on a perfect life from an imperfect person. You just decided out of the blue to write a book, which is, I mean, my hat's off to you. That's just a gutsy move, dude.
Yeah.
Like, what did it say? I think it said in the bio that I read, you were 39. You were 39 and you were like, just write a book. Why not?
It was on my list of things I wanted to do. And you realize you're not going to live forever. And so let's give this thing a shot. And I announced that I was like, I'm going to do a new record, because I knew I was wanting to do a new record, and I'm going to do a book with it. So people rallied behind that, and it became this exciting thing. But I could not have underestimated the difficulty of writing a book more. I just thought, I write songs, I write posts on Instagram, like, how, you know. Yeah, it was a challenge. It really was.
What do you, I mean, tell me about the first day. What's the first day like when you sit down and it's just a blank computer screen?
The first day is pretty good because you're like, all right, you know, I'll just do a little of this, a little bit of that. It's kind of like the third day where your heart breaks, you know, because you're like, all right, I have this kind of mess of ideas. And not having ever done a book, I didn't realize how useful it is to sort of outline what you think it might be first, and then kind of fill in spaces. It took me almost 2 years to get to realize, like, because I was just amassing little stories and fragments, and I'm like, I don't even know what this book is about. And I had some really good help in sort of honing in on what the book that I was the most useful book I could write at this stage of my life. And so it really went from originally being sort of like a list of road stories from a guy who is, you know, done fine, but is not known by the wide world, really. So it's like, who was going to pick this up and be interested? I have great stories, but I didn't, it wasn't really the book that was in me. You know, the book I ended up writing was more about, you know, hey, here's the best stuff that I can offer you to a life well lived. You know, this is, if nothing else, they'll be amusing stories, but I think they could also be inspiring. And so let me tell you some of the mistakes I've made and see if it can be of use in your own life. And that was when I really started, the book started to, but at that point I'd been in it 2.5 years, you know, screwing around, missing the mark, getting things wrong. And then it took me another 2 years to finish that from there, you know? So
thoughts on a perfect life from an imperfect person. What, I mean, I have to ask the obvious question. What's a perfect life?
Okay. I have an answer for you, John. And I only have an answer because I did a talk 2 weeks ago for a company. And I was like, I gotta hone in on this because it has come up before. Nice. You know, I think a perfect life, I'm going to tie it back to looking at your life and being able to say to yourself, I wouldn't trade places with anybody. Like, that's success. I think too often we're focused so much on money and just accolades and achievement and all this stuff. To me, success is, I wouldn't trade. I wouldn't change places with anybody. And that means, you know, you've got to look at your whole, that forces you to look at your whole picture, your wife and your children and your friends and your family members and your good laughs that you've had. And you go, would I trade that to be this? And if you're able to answer no, then that is as successful as you can possibly be. I mean, that is as close. And if you don't have that, that's okay. Nothing to be depressed about. But then the question becomes, what measures can we take to get to a life we wouldn't trade with anybody, you know? And not just being stupid about it, like, well, a hot model and $1 million. Like, you got to think a little deeper than that. But I think that's the question that you ask yourself to move towards a perfect life, you know?
Great answer. I'm glad I asked you something that you had prepared already, too.
I don't know. Is it? I can't tell.
No. I mean, I'm sorry. There was no sarcasm there. That was awesome. Thank
cool.
you.
Oh
that
yeah,
was really awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah, dude. I was gonna go into some silly shit after that, but now I'm.
You just can no take it in the moment. That's the thing. That's what Whitesnake did, though. They took you on the journey. It was like, nice. Here I go again, rock and roll. But then, is nice. This love? And you're feeling the pain, and it's good. It's good right. to have variety.
Well, before we talk about this event, I listened to a podcast that you were on where you talked about the unpredictability of Fairfield County audiences.
Oh yeah,
and Connecticut. I mean, you know, you're a CT guy. I've played music in Connecticut for 20 years. CT is such a weird state because we're so small. There's so much talent here. We're stuck between two of the biggest art cities in the country. What's your most and least favorite thing about the Connecticut music scene?
Well, my most favorite thing is, like you said, this state is loaded with talent. I mean, the Alternate Roots, Javier Colon, Nick Fratiani, Fuzz, and Deep Banana Blackout. I mean, these are big talents on an international scale. I mean, these are people who've built careers, and they're all just available. I mean, everybody I know in this community goes out and is willing to talk to young people and do mentor sessions. It's a really lovely musical community. So that's my favorite thing about it. Yeah. My least favorite thing about it is, I know this might sound harsh. I'm just going to shoot straight though. It feels like, having traveled the world playing music, I don't know that I've ever played to a more entitled group, like fan base. There are shows, and I'm not just talking about my own shows. I'm talking about when I take my kids to see Ed Sheeran and the business people who got the best seats in the house don't even bother to clap after songs. And it's like, do you realize how lame that is? You know, that these artists aren't just here to provide a soundtrack to your booze. Like, it's like, you know, you can throw a concert, you can throw a party, but I am horrified by that, by the way I see, you know, quiet artists who people talk through the whole thing at the bar. And these are like A-level artists, you know. It's always bothered me. I've seen it in Connecticut more than I've seen it other places. Having said that, I've had great shows in Connecticut. I'm not hating on my home state. I think that I'd love to see this state embrace its talent more and take a little more of a, hey, wow, aren't we proud of our local heroes for what they've been able to do out in the world? And I challenge Connecticut audiences to really show up and emote and be there, be part of it like the rest of the world is,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But maybe it's because we have so much of good stuff available to us. I don't know. I sound like I'm hating. I'm not. I'm really challenging a lot of my peers and people around me here to like get out there and show the love for your Connecticut artists, you know?
No, I completely understand what you're talking about. Have you heard of Goose? Have you heard of the band Goose?
Yeah.
So I interviewed those guys a couple of years ago. It was right before they really blew up, actually. And I asked them the same question, and they said it took them a while to win over their home state. Like, they had to go to Kentucky, get big down there.
Yeah.
And then they were starting to get followings like all these like myriad places that they would travel around. And then they came home, and then all of a sudden it was a hometown hero thing. And then all of a sudden everybody was, you know, very excited. I think it's a common experience. I think we're jaded, you know, in a lot of ways. But I think that it's why there's so much talent that comes out of this part of the country. It's because the bar is just set so high for just the bar down the street. Like, you expect that guy to be like a, like, what would be a, what would be a national talent in any other, in any other part of the country. You just expect that now.
Yeah, no, I know. It is. There's a, there's an intense, one time I was out on tour and the, one of the guys in my band said, well, look, you got to be like the most famous dude from your high school class. That's got to count for something. And I said, not only am I not the most famous person in my high school class, it's like Justin Long, you know, famous, great guy, famous actor, James Blake.
I was going to say, Mayer's got to be about your age too,
John,
right?
Mayer, of course. I mean, I know John, like John Mayer, James Blake, Chris Drury, and I, you know, NHL Rookie of the Year. I'm like, I don't even know if I make the top 10 on that list. But, you know, but that's good. And that goes, it's a, John, what you're saying is something I will consider. There is a high bar, but it's a two-way street, you know, like you gotta root for your people. And it's weird to me to go to New York and Boston and even Northampton, Mass, and have such more appreciative audiences than some of what I've encountered in Connecticut over the years, you know, and I see it at other people's shows. Not me. I mean, I really sound like I'm throwing down against my own people, but I'm not.
I don't think so. Yeah. I don't think so at all. All right. Well, so tell me about this event that you're doing on Saturday, which is for CT venues and featuring Connecticut artists. So we can turn this narrative around.
We can turn it around.
There's still a chance. I mean, this thing is so cool. You know, you mentioned Fuzz before. You know, I know Caravan Thieves is going to be on this thing. A bunch of Nicole, who's amazing, the wife of the great Benny McCullough from the Alpaca Gnomes, is organizing this thing. And she's done Celebrate Shelton. She's just an incredible person in this scene. Was telling me all about this lineup, but tell me what got you on the project initially.
Look, I mean, you know, so after what I just said, notwithstanding, when I saw that the Connecticut Folk Fest, you know, was happening last year, I called my agent and I was like, a Connecticut Folk Fest? Please let me be part of this. Like, this is where I'm from. This is my home. I want to be piped into it. And they had such a great lineup. And I was so thrilled when I was asked, and then checked out the other acts, the Moonshells and Roe Godwin, and who I got to meet on a little promo thing earlier this week, and of course the Caravan of Thieves, who I'm friends with. So I am probably the type of parent that I am, like, artist too, in that I'm gonna call it like I see it. Like, I think there have been, I've seen, you know, you asked me about Connecticut audiences and I gave you an honest answer. Yeah. But having said that, I always play Connecticut. I always bring my A game. I always show up, and I believe in the, you know, I didn't move to Nashville when we discussed it. I'm from New England. I'm from Connecticut. I'm a nutmeg skater. Right, so on. I will be the guy that will call you out and say, be a good audience. But also, like, I'm always going to play here, and I was honored to be asked. And I'll always, you know, I say yes when I get asked to play in Connecticut, you know, pretty.
Oh, yeah, man.
I do it a lot. So I have a lot of experience with this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You guys are going to be live streamed at the State House, you know, fantastic venue in New Haven. Suggested donation for the event is going to be $20. But again, suggested donation. If you have less, pay a little bit less, and you can get your tickets. And I'll throw this link up on here. I should have done this before at ctfolk.org. And Steven, before we get out of here, dude, what do you got on the horizon? What's next?
Well, this will be my first show at a venue in half a year, other than that's not my basement in the studio. So I've been thinking a lot about this Saturday night. And we're gonna do a bit more of this, but then I'm gonna start work on a new record, and we're just trying to figure out where and how, and, you know, like the rest of the world, when is it safe to stick our head up out of the hole and kind of be with people in a safe way. And until then, we'll keep embracing the virtual shows. I feel genuine connection through all of this. So we'll keep doing that. And until it becomes safe to go out again, and then we'll go back out there, you know?
Well, dude, you've played thousands of shows. You wrote a book. I'm excited to see what you're going to do next, dude. I appreciate you sitting down with me tonight, man. Stephen Kellogg, check him out. StephenKellogg.com. How many albums do you have streaming on streaming services right now?
Seven,
bunch of EPs.
Start with the recent stuff and work backwards is my advice on all that.
There you go. All right. Well, you can check them out at the CT Folks Homegrown Folk Festival. It's going to be live streamed this Saturday. You can get your tickets at ctfolk.org. Steven, stick around for a sec after I take us off the live stream, but thank you again, man.
Got it. Honored to be here.